Good morning and welcome back. Welcome back to Provence. Welcome back to our fourth lecture, our bonus lecture on Jewish medieval Provence. Let me start by doing a brief review of what we've seen until now and then contrasting that with what we're about to view today. So until now, what we've done is we've given a brief overview of the history of Provence, which is totally loaded and there's a lot to read about that. We've seen that it was a very sort of pivotal time in Jewish history, turned politically and also intellectually. And after that, we studied what I would say two more conservative, traditional rabbinic thinkers, Moshe HaDarshan, who was focused on the sermon, on creative ways of looking at Tanakh in order to bring out important messages to his community. And then last week, we still focus on Rabbi Avraham Ibn David, also known as the Ravid in rabbinic parlance, who was a very fierce defender of tradition and who had a very traditional for his time outlook. Today, and I hope everyone hears me okay, today we are going to focus on Rabbi Menachem Meiri. And Rabbi Menachem Meiri is a very different figure in Jewish history. Someone who definitely had a new and different perspective on Torah and on Judaism and on the world and very important social topics. I think you might, by our standards today, you could even call him progressive, which is something to say for someone who lived in the 13th century in Provence. So I'm very excited to share him with you. And I want to show, though, how we're going to talk about, I guess, two aspects of the Meiri here. One is just his general contribution to scholarship. He was an incredible scholar of all parts of Torah and even open to secular knowledge as well. And I think that's worth appreciating, that in and of itself, his contribution to Torah. And then beyond that, we'll note how he had some very innovative opinions on a lot of important topics in his time that were definitely different. And so I'm excited to share that with you. So with that, let's begin the slideshow. I'm going to share my screen with you. And we'll learn a little bit about his life. Okay. Hopefully everybody can see. Rabbi Menachem Meiri. So the Meiri was born in, from what we know, 1249. We don't know exactly where he was born. It's a little bit unclear. He was born in southern France, as we've noted, as we've said. We know that he lived most of his life near, I'm not going to pronounce this right, so don't make fun of me. I'm just going to pronounce it as if it was like, you know, generally a normal English spelling. It's, you know, Perpignan, France. Maybe it's Perpignan. I'm going to go with that. We know he lived most of his life there. It's unclear where he was born. Would you like to see that on the map? Would that be helpful? Maybe I'll just show that quickly. If you take a look over here, I have a Google Maps. I don't know if it's the exact same locations as it was back then, but so if you take a look at over here, this is a bit of a zoomed out view. Over here is Spain. Over here, you have the rest of France. This is the very southern edge of France. So the Meiri was born lived most of his life around here. Again, Perpignan, we spoke about Narbonne, which was a very big Jewish community. Here you see Marseille, what we call Provence today, is more to the north. If you zoom in a little bit, so you see that he's right near Spain, which is going to be important because Spain was another Jewish center. And he's also on the border of, and he's also in between Spain and the more northern France, which is also a big community. If you zoom out a little bit, zoom in a little bit, you'll see, you can see greater detail where these places were in relation to each other. Here, one second, please. There you go. It's hard to navigate this. There you go. Okay. That should be a decent view. So you see, here's, you know, Montpellier, you go further down is Narbonne, and here is Perpignan. Okay? In terms of the geography. And when you take your next Jewish tour of France, make sure to stop by those places. Back to the life of the Meiri. We don't know that much about his life. You know, that's what happens when you live a long time ago in a very tumultuous time. He refers to his father, in terms of his family, refers to his father numerous times as a great Torah scholar. I say, nor here there's evidence his father passed away at a young age. We had that evidence because he wrote one of his works called Chibor HaTshuvah, which is his work on repentance, at a much younger age. And in that work, he refers to his father with the term Zatzal, Zefer Tzadik L'Racha, may the righteous be remembered for a blessing, which means that his father must have passed away at a young age. He's called Rabbi Menachem Hamiri. His name was Menachem ben Shlomo. His father's name was Shlomo. He's called Meiri, presumably because there was a very prominent ancestor of his named Meir. And therefore, he's called Meiri. Who exactly that Meir was is unclear. There were a number of his family members who he refers to as great rabbis who were called Meir. There are different possibilities mentioned. If you want a more secular name, we also have on record that he was called Don Baital Solomon Meir, known as Mr. Son of Shlomo Meir. We had that on a contract. In terms of his other family, he refers to many great Torah scholars as Zikei Ninu, our grandfather, including Rabbi Abraham Ibn David, who we learned about last week. So he comes from a rabbinic family. And it's worth noting, as we'll get to later, he's a contemporary of Rabbi Shlomo Ibn Aderet, the Rashba, who's a very prominent Spanish rabbinic scholar. And we'll get to their correspondence in a bit later. So he's a very well-known rabbi in his time. Unfortunately, from what we do know about his life, it wasn't that enjoyable. He had a tough, difficult life. In his intro to Pirkei Avot, if you know about Pirkei Avot begins with a detailing of the passing over of the tradition from one generation to another. And the Meiri has a monumental treatment of that because he writes in great detail about how the tradition was transferred from the beginning of the revelation when Moses got it at Sinai all the way to his time. So he talks about Moshe, and then the prophets, and then the judges, and then the writers of the Mishnah, the Tanaim, and the writers of the Gemara, and the Geonim, and the next generation, Sabaraim, rabbis who explain the Gemara, and on until his own time. So it's a really remarkable work of history. He opens that up with the following. From the time of Rabbi Hananel, was one of the earlier medieval scholars, Rishonim, the wisdom of the sages has decreased. And the importance of written works has increased. Meaning he writes, now we had to start writing things down because it was difficult to maintain our tradition. Why? For the time of the passing of Rav Hai, tragedies have increased. The hearts of men have been stolen away toward the secular world from the multitude of needs due to taxes, duties, and the pressures of the nation upon us. Right? So he lives in a tumultuous time. Immediately following the Crusades, before the Meiri was born, the Talmud, the famous burning of the Talmud near Notre Dame, occurred. So this was a difficult time to live in. There was a lot of pressure from the monarchies around the Jewish community. And he writes about his own personal life, although he might be sort of reflecting about the community. This is in his intro to Kiryat Sefer, which is his work on the laws of Sefer Torah. The Meiri writes as follows. When God caused me to wander from my father's house. That's a quote from the Tumash in reference to Avraham Avinu. Avraham says, Kasher hitu Elokim mibeit avi. When God caused me to wander from my father's house, when his anger poured down upon me and his wrath destroyed my surroundings. That's actually a quote from Miguel Echa. He led me through darkness, not light. He put my sons as refugees and my daughters in captivity. Now, that's also a reference from the Chumash. That's a quote from Deuteronomy, where it's actually sort of like a poem about Sichon. But if we take him literally, he's literally saying that his children were taken captive from him at a young age. So his children were kidnapped, if we take him literally. So it was not an easy time for the Meiri. He did not have the easiest life. So much for the biography. Let's learn a bit about his scholarship. The Meiri was a tremendous Torah scholar in all areas of Torah, but he had a very innovative approach. Just here's a record of his works here in this slide. He wrote about repentance. We'll learn a little bit about that. He wrote a book about called Kiryat Sefer, the laws of writing Torah scrolls. That's very important because to preserve the Masoretic text, to preserve the exact verbiage in the Torah, was quite a task, and we've done it from generation to generation. And the Meiri in this time had an authoritative take on the exact text of the Sefer Torah. That's what that book's about. He also wrote a book called Magen Avot. Now this is also interesting because we noted that the Meiri lived in between France and Spain, right? Now, that's significant because as time went on, the greatest Torah scholars came from Spain. And some of them eventually made it to Provence. And you can imagine when you have great Torah scholars from one community come to another community, there may be points of disagreement about how exactly, you know, to observe Jewish law and Jewish customs. And so these rabbis wanted to make modifications to provincial customs. They wanted to change the way things were being done in France based on their own customs. So one example, I bring you the source here, but the custom of saying in Shema, Kel Melech Ne'eman, the words Kel Melech Ne'eman before saying the word, the beginning Shema, was a custom that was observed in France and was not observed in Spain. And the Spanish rabbis came to Provence and tried to change it. They said, you're doing it all wrong. The Meiri wrote this work defending the customs of his community. That's what Magen Avot is about. It's all about preserving. Magen Avot literally means, anybody know? What's Magen mean? What's a Magen? Magen is a shield, right? Go for that, sir. So what does Magen Avot mean?
A shield to protect.
A shield of the fathers, right? So we say Magen Avot on Shabbat. It's part of our liturgy, but literally he wrote it because he's protecting his fathers. He's protecting the customs of his community's tradition from sort of these attacks from Spain. He also wrote a commentary on Proverbs, on Mishle, which is, that was actually promulgated earlier in his time. But as we'll see, his groundbreaking work was commentary on the Talmud. Before we go on, and I know there's a lot of history here, there is one really sort of striking aspect of the Meiri's history and his works, and it's unclear why this is so. The Meiri was a prominent Torah scholar in his day, and universally acclaimed. However, after his time period, after he passed away, his works were not so widely disseminated. They did not become part of the rabbinic corpus. In fact, most of his works didn't reemerge until the 20th century. Think about that. 600 years we didn't have Meiri's writings. And it's a bit unclear why, although maybe we'll see today what some reasons why that might have been. However, it's worth noting because some of his perspectives weren't so widely accepted. But let's take a look at some of his ideas here. Okay. So the first thing I want to look at is the Meiri on Shuvah. And before I do that, let me put a question out there to the crowd. Okay, if I were to ask you, if you could describe for me in one word, what is the most important element of Shuvah, of repentance, of improving your spiritual activity? What is the most important thing that you need? The most important quality, right? What would you suggest?
Acting on it.
Sorry again, Paul?
Acting on it.
Acting on it. Okay, following through. Okay, that's important. Following through, not just making resolutions, but actually bring them to fruition.
And sincerity.
What'd you say?
Sincerity.
Sincerity, okay. To be sincere. Beautiful. Anything else?
Acknowledgement.
Acknowledgement, okay, that's what we're going to talk about. Acknowledging you did something wrong. These are all fair. Yes, Mark? Can't hear you. Sorry about that. Okay. These are all great. Take a look at what the Meiri says here. I don't think, you know, it's so, you know, controversial, but I think it's worth noting. And I want to start off with some of the Meiri's just Torah, just pure, unadulterated Torah, and then we can get some of his controversial opinions on matters. So take a look at what he says here in this slide. This is in his Chibur HaTshuva. So first we quote a pasuk from Tehillim, and the pasuk in Tehillim says, I'll read it, it says, true sacrifice to God is a contrite spirit. God, you will not despise a contrite and crushed heart. In Hebrew, Zichrei Elokim Ruach Nishbara, right? True sacrifice is a broken ruach, a broken spirit. Lev Nishbar v'neke Elokim lo tivzeh. God never despises a contrite and crushed heart. And here in the Hebrew says, the essence of tshuva and its foundation and root and character, tshuva meaning repentance, returning, is the submission of the heart. It's humility. Meaning when the human heart stands from heaven and trembles and mourns about his sins and all the other elements of tshuva are branches of this root. It's a certain humility and, as Paul said, acknowledgement. You can't do tshuva, says the Meiri, until you look yourself in the mirror and say, I did something wrong. I made a mistake. What I did was wrong. And that can be very hard to do. It requires saying, you know, I have flaws and I have certain things I might be proud of, but I have to recognize that I have deficiencies and I have to do my best to fix them. I made a big mistake. Everything else is just figuring out how to bring that to fruition. For the morning that a person will perform on account of his sin is what will frighten him and bring him to awaken to repentance. And if he is not hurt and doesn't fear his sin, no cause will wake him and he will remain immersed in his actions. I think the Meir here is very sensitive to a certain psychological reality, and that is change is difficult. Change doesn't happen naturally. It's much easier to continue doing what we already do, our habits, what we've the behavior we've already habituated ourselves to. If you want to make a change, it's not going to be enough to say, you know what? That wasn't so good, but, you know, it was just a mistake. No, it has to hurt you. It has to bother you. And that, in order to feel that pain, to feel that actually bothered, to truly mourn when you do something wrong, Meiri tells us that requires humility. It requires certain submission. And that's the root of repentance. Okay. I don't know. Any thoughts about that? Comments? Do we agree or disagree? I think it's an interesting take in terms of that. I think often nowadays, we'll admit that we made a mistake, but we'll often say, okay, everybody makes mistakes. And that's important. That's true. But it should also bother us that when we do something wrong, we should be able to look ourselves in the mirror and say, that wasn't okay. I need to improve. It's not okay that I continue to do this. There needs to be a change. And that's the Meiri suggesting here. Okay. That is the Meiri on Teshuvah. Moving on. So here, and again, I apologize, this is a bit academic in nature, but the Meiri had an incredible contribution to Talmudic scholarship. Moshe raises his hand. Go for it, Moshe. Take a break from the slide you said. Yeah.
Oh, good morning.
Morning.
It's not for me to dispute with the Meiri. Plus, he's one of my great, great heroes, as you may mention later. But I'm not sure that his idea of teshuva is everybody's or should be everybody's. Because I think the real essence of teshuva is how do you grow in a principled way? And for some people, you know, spending too much or really any time over what they did in the past is totally unhelpful. Not only unhelpful, it turns people away. You know, for the people who want to do that way, sure. But I think it's just equally true to say that, you know, a person can turn around and say, you know, it's like the classic story about in the Gemara about the Roman soldier who saves some Gödel's a second of pain by ending his life, and he goes right to Olam Haba. Because the important thing is, how do you keep growing? And if you spend all your time you know, worrying about all the things you did in the past, you know, that's fine, but not necessarily a way of growing. And to be honest with you, I'm not so sure how tshuva of this sort was featured in the past. I wouldn't be surprised if it really grew out of Christian self-mortification for a thousand years.
Okay. Over. So it's actually interesting because the Meiri was in correspondence with Christians, and he actually writes that one of his motivations for writing this is because people were saying that, oh, Jews never focus on repentance. So you make a good point. I have to disagree, though, with some of the things that you said. I'll say it this way. There are definitely different perspectives toward tshuva. And I would argue, I've given a shiur about this, and I can send you a link. I think Rav Avraham Yitzchak Cohen Cook, and certainly focuses on a more positive aspect of tshuva, and that's certainly true. That being said, I don't think you can have a sincere tshuva if you don't spend any time thinking about how you have to improve, because you can't improve unless you acknowledge what you've done wrong. And I think to simply focus, okay, hey, I'm not going to think about what I've done wrong, I'm just going to try to improve in the past. I don't think it's being, just my perspective, is not being totally intellectually honest. Let me say that I don't think we should be encumbered by the grief. I don't think it should get in the way of improving. That's certainly true. But I think that the eerie saying is you're not really going to make the hard changes if you don't look yourself in the eye and they don't bother you. It's easy to say I'm going to be better in the future. Everyone wants to be better. But when something that really requires effort to change, when it's a big part of who you are and there is something that needs to be rectified, I think the Meiri is saying that you're not going to rectify it. You might say, I want to be better, but unless you acknowledge that it's wrong and it bothers you, you'll probably just continue. I think that's what he's arguing here. Yes,
no, I don't disagree. I think there's, you know, more than one point of view on this issue. Anyway, okay. But go ahead. Yeah. I don't disagree.
Yes.
As we discussed, he's very progressive in this. I think this concept fits very well with today. Today, we want to stay current in our thoughts. We want to understand where we came from, where we're heading. We question ourselves much more, even though we're fully grown adults. I think this is a very modern concept, and maybe it was very unusual in that time.
Interesting. The Meiri, I totally agree. Meiri, as we'll see, is very innovative. I think this particular point is not necessarily the most innovative. I think, you know, humility is something that you'll find in many writings on repentance. But I agree with you saying, I think it is very relevant to today's day and age. Okay. So that's a bit, again, you could do, as I mentioned to Esther before this year, you could do a PhD, like 7 PhDs in the Meiri. You could do a PhD on his work on repentance and its innovations and how he interpreted the Bible. You could do a PhD on his correspondence with Spanish scholars, but there's so much to cover. Let's get a bit of a taste of some of the other aspects of his scholarship. Okay. I want to talk a bit about the commentary of the Meiri. Let me return a bit to the Rambam. We talked about the Rambam and Maimonides and his commentary on Talmud called Mishneh Torah. And let me put it this way, okay? The Rambam basically tried to take Gemara and make it halacha. What do I mean by the difference between Gemara and halacha? Or Talmud and Jewish law? What would you say the difference is between those two disciplines? What's the difference between Talmud and Jewish law?
Talmud is a work in progress. It's
the
foundation, but it's not law.
Right, exactly. So the Talmud is not a law book. The Talmud is a discussion. The Talmud has, you know, you'll have a question like, you know, let's say, do mitzvah, we'll get, this is a good example, do commandments require kavanah? So you need to have a cognitive aspect and awareness of what you're doing to fulfill a mitzvah. And the Gemara will go back and forth. It will ask a question. It will give an answer. It will give a proof. It will reject the proof. But it's an ongoing discussion. The Rambam saw that and said, you know what? Most people don't have time for that. People are busy. People have jobs. It's difficult. Who has time to go through all the back and forth? I'm going to streamline it for you, says the Rambam. I'm going to tell you, bottom line, what do I need to do? I'm going to tell you what you need to do for every single aspect of your life. Look at the Rambam. He'll tell you what you need to do, bottom line. Now, on the one hand, that's very useful. It's practical. Like, if you want a guidebook to how to live your life, you can look at the Rambam. You can skip all the, you know, intellectual back and forth and all the questions and answers. But what would be the flaw with that work? What problem might arise from such a work? And I could phrase the question differently, okay? You know, if you had a lecture and the lecture is titled, I don't know, let's say, The Laws of Building a Sukkah, okay? And the rabbi gets up there and says, okay, here's what you need to do. A sukkah needs to be so and so high, and you know, you have to have these dimensions, and this is what you make it out of, and this is what you do on the first day. This is how you take the four species, and it just tells you what to do. Who's going to that lecture? Right? Not that many people. Like, the lectures which say laws of X and just talk about those laws are not that captivating. They're not that interesting, and it's hard to just read them. And I'd argue that not only that, it's often hard to remember all that. If it's just a bunch of dry facts, it's going to be hard for you to really incorporate that into your memory. So the Meiri looked at the Rambam, looked at the problems that he faced, and he tried to bridge the gap. He had an even more ambitious project than the Rambam. The Meiri looks at the Rambam and the Talmud and says, look, on the one hand, I totally hear what the Rambam is trying to do. It's difficult to read the Talmud and come to any conclusion. It's confusing, there's questions, there's answers, it goes on tangents, it's disorganized. I understand what the Rambam is doing. But it's hard to read a book like that and be satisfied. People have intellectual curiosity. People want to know the source of things. People want to know the logic behind them. People don't just want to be told what to do. If I tell you you need to do X, Y, and Z, a very natural question to ask is, why? How do you know? Why do I have to do that? Where did that come from? The Rambam doesn't tell us that. So the Meiri says, you know what? I want to go a little bit further than the Rambam. Take a look what he says here. This is introduction. And that it is a more pleasant way for men by nature to obtain knowledge of things from the inquiry and search and examination of the things with the most contradictory end. Contradictory end meaning, don't just tell me what to do. Tell me the other opinion, which is against what you're saying to do, and tell me why it's wrong, right? If you're a progressive, don't just tell me what you think. Tell me what the conservatives think and tell me why they're wrong. It's a much more holistic way of learning. And just to tell me what to do, it's hard to stay with that, right? That's how people like to learn. Then to obtain their knowledge through acceptance alone, right? I don't want to just accept what you're telling me. And it did not cool any educated mind until he sees the study of things, their source and origin. It's not going to, if I'm curious and I'm inquisitive, you just tell me what to do, that's not going to satisfy me. And the reasoning of the opposing arguments and the long-winded back and forth. The questions and answers of Talmud are important because they, you know, sort of get you. They grab your mind. They get you in a line of thinking. They get your attention. And the Meiri is not willing to part with the Talmud and just give you the bottom line. And he has a very innovative way of doing that. But he also wants to make it approachable for people who are going to get confused by the style of the Gemara. And so he says as follows. After seeing the source of things and their root and the matters of their interrogation, a person will then desire to know what will come out of them through a ruling and to observe them from the study what is a straight path. Meaning you want to study, it's research, right? Meiri saying you want to do research. You want to look at the topic, explore from all angles, and also then know what to do. Both of those steps are important. Just inquiry is important, but if without knowing what to do, it's lacking. So I'm going to tell you all the different sides of the argument, all the angles, all the concepts, all the opinions. I'm going to organize them for you, and I'm also going to tell you what to do practically. And that's what he tries to do. And this is the approach that we have chosen in the Talmudic commentaries, that we have to clarify the issue completely and without any shortcomings and extend at length everything that is said and then clarify through a ruling what should be clarified, as we noted in our introduction. says in the Erie, I'm going to go a step further than the Rambam. I'm going to write a running commentary on the entirety of Talmud, all the aspects of it. And I'm gonna organize it for you. I'm gonna make it readable. I'm gonna make it approachable and lucid, and in a way that you can just pick up the Meiri and read it. But it's gonna be satisfying, intellectually stimulating. So I want to, again, and I can't, like, if you really want to get a sense of this, you know, for those of us in the audience who have it more of an advanced background, open the Meiri. I love the Meiri. As someone who studies Talmud pretty consistently, the Meiri is wonderful. But let me try to give you a bit of what he did here, okay? Number one, the Meiri has introductory material. This is very innovative. Let's talk about most commentaries, okay? Most commentaries on the Talmud, and we'll get back to sides in a second. What's a commentary on the Talmud? Here's how it works. You open up the Talmud, and there's this text, again, questions, answers, back and forth, tangents, all that stuff. And then you have a rabbi who comments on various, you know, selections of the Talmud and tells you their questions and their answers and how they solve the problem, right? So they're not your friend to help you understand it better. They make it more confusing most of the time. They make it even harder to understand. Again, they're great. If you want to understand at a deep level, that's what you got to do. But they're going to bring more questions. They're not going to organize it for you. They're not going to give you a comment on the whole thing. They're only going to explain those comments which they seem difficult or they want to elucidate, right? So they'll comment on one point in the Gemara and they'll ask a question on it. And then they'll give an answer to it. And then they'll quote a totally different section which relates to it. But if you don't know, like, the context, it's going to be very difficult. That's not what the Meiri does. The Meiri tries to give you all the background material you need to be able to approach this topic and understand it. And he'll take material from other parts of the Talmud. He'll take he'll organize it. He'll tell you the concepts that you're about to be introduced to ahead of time. It's really remarkable, and it's incredibly organized. And again, this was not common. This is not the way that rabbis wrote commentary, but the Meiri did. So a brief note on some of the things he did. Every tractate has a summary of the main topics covered in that tractate. Tractates are divided into chapters. Before every chapter, he gives you a summary of the topics in the chapter. And then before each topic, each Mishnah, he tells you what the main topics of the Mishnah are. He elucidates them, and then he goes into the Talmud. And furthermore, when the Talmud goes on a tangent, right, and the Talmud does all the time go on tangents, he'll tell you, this is the main topic of the discussion. Here's a tangent. And he'll delineate for you what's really pertinent to the main topic of discussion and what's sort of side material. Now, all that's incredibly helpful to people who, you know, weren't necessarily equipped to know all of that. See a comment in the chat. It'd definitely be interesting to see a page of an example. I'd love to do that. We're going to give you a bit of an example. Again, it'd be too much to do in one share to go through a whole topic within the Erie. But let me give you this example, okay? This is an introduction to Tractate Brachot. Tractate Brachot is the first tractate in the Talmud. And the Meiri, before getting into any of the content of the Talmud itself, tells you what's in it. Okay, he says as follows. And the matter of the whole tractate would indeed usually be directed to clarify four esteemed matters. Number one, to clarify the nature of the declaration of unity that we must declare toward he, may he be blessed. What is the declaration of unity called? What's the Meiri referring to? He tells you this, but anybody know? What declaration of unity is he referring to? When do we declare God's unity? What prayer is that?
Shema.
Shema, yeah. Number one, topic number one, Shema. Number two, to clarify the features, the types of prayers we're obligated to pray every day. Brachot is about davening, about Shacharit, Mincha, and Arvit. Three, to clarify the character of the blessings we're obligated to bless him upon every pleasure that comes upon us, whether through eating, drinking, smell, or any pleasure. Topic number three, Brachot, blessings before eating, blessings after eating, blessings before, like, a smell, like we do on Motzei Shabbat, Bereminei Bitsamin, blessings, all types of blessings that a person should recite to thank God for receiving their pleasure from this world. And number four, the character of blessings, you're obligated to bless him upon anything that happens to us, whether good or bad, how we do so for each matter, and how we need to contemplate and give thanks for all that reaches us, whether we see or hear new things, for all is from him. Right? Bracha, Baruch, Dayan, Ha'emet. Blessed is the truthful judge after someone passes away. The Baruch, Baruch, Shachayan, V'kiyamanu, Higyan, Lazman, Azeh. Blessed are you for bringing us to our in our lives to this point. When a nice thing happens, that's what brachot is about. So again, this is a very brief snippet, but it's helpful to know when you're looking through a tractate, and there's going to be all sorts of tangents and all sorts of side discussions to have in mind. Okay, but these are the main topics that I'm looking for from this tractate. Is there an English translation of Meiri? Maybe Sepharia has some. I don't know of one, unfortunately, but you can look around. I don't know of one, but here's the thing, though. The Meiri is very it's not like you need to have some background knowledge, but as rabbinic commentaries go, it's very lucid Hebrew. It's very lucid writing. You're right, and in clear, organized prose. Number one, it's a running commentary. You don't even need the Talmud. You could pick up the Meiri and just read that, and it will be comprehensible. Or you could read it along with studying the topic. Most commentaries cannot be read alone. They're indecipherable unless you're familiar with the Talmud beforehand. The Meiri, you could read on its own. And it's conceptually organized. It's not just based on the order of the Talmud. He takes each concept and deals with that on its own. And after doing all that, he also goes into the text and clarifies the questions that need to be clarified and clarifies the answers that need to be clarified and presents different opinions. And his language, I know I'm rushing, there's a lot here. His language is as close to modern Hebrew as you'll find in rabbinic commentary. Most rabbinic commentaries are a mixture of Aramaic and Hebrew, and they vacillate back and forth. And it's hard to read unless you're familiar with Talmud. Meir is pure, simple Hebrew. So again, you could write, and people have written PhDs on the Meiri's Talmudic commentary. There's a ton there, but it's incredibly innovative and useful. And it's remarkable that it did become part of the halakhic corpus. So much for the Meiri just generally and his contribution to Torah. Now let's talk a bit about some of his more progressive stances on issues. Number one, the Meiri was a Maimonidean, meaning he was a student, not literally, but at least, you know, conceptually, of the Rambam. The Meiri had a lot of deference to the Rambam. In fact, in his Talmudic commentary, he always quotes the Rambam's commentary on Mishnah and then provides you with his own. Now, that is significant because, and I believe later in the year, we'll have an opportunity to discuss this when we have our series later in the year with the help of God on the Guide for the Perplexed. The Rambam was very controversial, although the Rambam today, at least halakhically, is widely accepted. It was not so in his time. And specifically in terms of his openness to philosophy, the Rambam was condemned. And rabbis in northern France actually banned the Rambam's books. They said, you can't read them. And there was a big back and forth between people like the Meiri and others, you know, defending the Rambam, and other rabbis like Rabbi Shlomo Minahar, or Shlomo of Montpellier from northern, who was very opposed to the Rambam. So the Meiri was on the rationalist side of things, and he was open to the study of philosophy. And this is a correspondence I have here in the slide. It's a letter he wrote to the Rashba. Again, Rabbi Shlomo Ibn Adeder was a prominent Spanish scholar who was a contemporary of the Meiri, and they correspond with each other. Rabbi Shlomo Ibn Adeder wrote that it's forbidden to study philosophy. He forbade... Do I have you still? I hope I do. He forbade the study of philosophy. Why do you think he did that? What is risky about the study of philosophy? Why were the rabbis of that time so opposed to it? What do you think?
It's open to interpretation. People are allowed to make their own conclusions.
Okay.
This is dangerous because...
Right. Okay, 100%.
Places you're not supposed to be.
How is it dangerous? What specifically might happen if people are sort of engrossed in the study of philosophy?
You stray away from Judaism.
Right. So that's what many rabbis are afraid of. It goes like this, right? So to give a very basic example, you have a mitzvah in the Torah. The mitzvah in the Torah just says, do so-and-so. Oh, I'm going to make up a random one. It says to sin the sukkah, right? Sin the sukkah and sukkah, you know, a nice innocuous mitzvah. Beautiful. Now the philosopher comes and says, well, what is really the lesson of sinning the mitzvah in sukkah? Maybe the lesson really is about, I'm going to make this up, going out there and appreciating nature, right? It's Tu B'Shvat tonight. That's what Sukkot is about. That's why we're outside. That's why we take four species. It's all about appreciating nature. It's not so crazy to then conceive of the following, okay? Someone will say, you know, Sukkot's about appreciating nature, but I have a different way of appreciating nature. I have a better way. You know, who needs the structure? I'm just going to literally sleep outside without any structure. Isn't that more a greater engagement with nature? Now, that's obviously a simplistic way of thinking, but that's the type of thing these rabbis were worried about, because philosophy is totally about reason. But what if in your thinking, you come to a conclusion which is against tradition? You know, there's no, like, there's, if we open up people to that sort of inquiry, they might not reach the conclusions that are, you know, conducive to living a Torah lifestyle. So Rav Shlomo Ibn Aderet banned philosophy. He said, you can't study philosophy. The Meiri did not agree. And here's what he writes here. But it's worth noting he's still cautious, but he did not agree. He says as follows, since the Spirit of God spoke to us in the books of the Rabbi, the righteous teacher, i.e. the Rambam, arrived in Israel, we have found in our communities wise men and great men who are famous in Torah and all kinds of virtues, proficient in all Talmudic and Mishnah orders, with their hands resourceful in wisdom and its books, and they have found discernment in its wisdom and secrets, meaning... We have Torah scholars who are rooted and grounded in the Torah tradition and then also study the wisdom of philosophy in Aristotle and Plato and the thinkers of those who studied then in the Middle Ages. But they did both. They were grounded in our tradition. They knew all of Torah, but they also used philosophy to enhance their understanding of Torah and the world. Many from the sages of the land as well know the wisdom of the Talmud on perfection. And he says here, actually, I don't have it for you in Hebrew, but he says, they know to me din kisidran musafin gehilchatan, which is a phrase from our liturgy, our musaf prayer. They know about the constant offerings and the additional offerings and the innovations and tosafot. They know about the commentaries in the Talmud according to the law. And yet, they're also proficient in wisdoms, whether in all or in most or in some. What is the Meiri saying here? He's not just saying, go for it. You know, like, all yours, just open your works of Aristotle or your secular philosophy, and it's a free-for-all. What he's saying is, though, that once you're grounded in our tradition internally and you're familiar with the Torah and you're familiar with all the codes and the Talmud, then it's healthy and it can be done to incorporate secular wisdom to enhance your spiritual persona, right? That's what he's saying. The people that you're railing against are incredible Torah scholars. That's what he's saying. We found people who have been able to do both. And you see it here as well. So if you look at our next source, so the Meir is commenting on Bava Kamma 83a. Bava Kamma 83a, the Talmud, which is not the most progressive work, we'll say to say the least, the Talmud basically says it's forbidden to study Greek wisdom. That's what the Talmud says. It calls it Chachma Yevanit. There's a bit of a discussion amongst the commentators, what Chachma Yevanit means. Does it mean Greek language, Greek wisdom? But that's what the Talmud discourages, studying Chachma Yevamit. Here is what the Meiri says on that Gemara. He says, the language of Greek has already been revealed as the most beautiful language, right? Why the Greek language is beautiful? You have a notion in the Talmud that it's legitimate to write a Torah scroll in Greek. That's a discussion in its own right. But for our purposes, we're more interested in the Greek wisdom. He says, nevertheless, it's forbidden to study their wisdom because it attracts a person's heart and destroys many of the fundamentals of religion. However, exception one, those close to the monarchy, since they need it, meaning philosophy and wisdom and secular knowledge for many matters, in carrying out their royal duties, for they were very attracted, they meaning the monarchy, were attracted to the pursuit of wisdom, and they only brought close those who were complete in the wisdoms and those whose mind was clear in all matters. They are permitted to learn it. So basically, dispensation number one, according to Meiri, who can study philosophy and secularism? Those who work in the government, those who interact with royal officials, they expect you to be able to speak the language of secular wisdom in order to carry out your royal duties. Then you can study it. However, even the complete sages, meaning Torah scholars, who have already filled their stomachs with meat and wine, and he's borrowing from the language of the Rambam here, meaning what does the meat and wine mean? The main stuff, the essentials, meaning the Torah and the Talmud, and the secrets of its commandments, you have no one closer to the kingdom than them. Right? So the Talmud says those close to the kingdom can study philosophy. And Meiri says there's another king who you can be close to and then study Talmud. Of course, which king is he referring to? He refers to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, God. If you're close to God, meaning if you've already achieved a certain, you know, fullness in your understanding of our tradition, and you can also study philosophy. After all, it was said, in me kings will reign. Bi melachim yimloch. Who is closer to the kingdom than those who are the greatest, right, the most righteous? And they are allowed to teach it in order to answer them, answer and strengthen the matter of religion with nails that will not fall. You can use philosophy to bolster and defend religion. So that's number one. Meiri is open to philosophy and secular wisdom. There's more to say about that, but that's the first innovation we see of the Meiri. Any questions about that? We good with philosophy? Okay. Let's talk about, now let's get more controversial. And before I talk about this, I just want to note that this is one stance on the issue. I think it's a stance that you'll like, right? As opposed to maybe a few of us that were upset, yes, last week about the Ravid stance on certain things, I think we'll be a lot more comfortable with the Eerie stance on things. Let me know, however, that his viewpoint was not widely accepted. Today, many rabbis bolster the Meiri. They harness the Meiri's viewpoint in defending our modern viewpoint on these issues, including Gentiles and our relationships with them. But this was not widely accepted. However, it's still remarkable to note. And there's a ton to say about this. There are PhDs about this. We can't cover all of it. But let's get a basic familiarity. The Talmud in general, and we could discuss why, has a complicated relationship with Gentiles, with people who are not Jewish, to say the least. The Talmud tries to limit our interaction with them, and frankly, I don't want to be apologetic, has different standards for behavior toward Gentiles and behavior toward Jews. There's no denying it, right? That's in the Talmud. Why that is a very interesting discussion. We could go back and forth for why that might have been. We'll talk about it a bit now and the Meiri stance on that. I would only note that, you know, there are many specific commandments and injunctions in the Torah to people of the covenant. Toward others, there's a more general notion of being a good person, you know, being generous and being understanding and not being cruel. Those are general notions that apply to all people. But the specific commandments of returning a lost object or, you know, not charging interest, the Talmud, many opinions of the Talmud say, don't apply to Gentiles. And I will just add, you know, that is somewhat bothersome. I'm not going to take away from that. You know, it certainly makes you think why that would be so. I would add, though, that there, you know, not religion isn't only about laws and laws and laws and laws, right? In fact, I would say that Christianity, one of the attacks on Judaism is about all our laws, where they just say, and I'm obviously generalizing, just be a good person. Just be a meek, humble, considerate person. That's the law. So, you know, I don't think there are many laws. There are other religions that don't have that many laws on the books, specific injunctions about how to treat others. Judaism does, but many of them in the Talmud's viewpoint are specifically geared toward people of the covenant. Let's hear Moshe Halbertal, who's a scholar in Jewish studies, delineates very clearly, and I gave him the link for his piece on this, for Edah, three types of laws pertaining to Jewish relations with Gentiles. Number one, you have commercial prohibitions, right? There are certain, you're not supposed to, limitations on business dealings and engagement with Gentiles, which are there to prevent the spread of idolatry or facilitating idolatrous ritual or causing Jews to engage with idolatry. So things like not, it says in the Talmud, and specifically tractate Avodah Zarah is a tractate dedicated toward dealings with Gentiles. And there is a law that you cannot do business with non-Jews around their holiday. Now, by the way, and I'll let me just introduce this with the following problem. Think about this, okay? Let's say for argument's sake, okay, that, and this is going to be part of our discussion in the 7 minutes we have left, so I'm already running out of time. Let's say for argument's sake that Christianity is idolatry. Let's say for argument's sake, it's a discussion, okay? And there's a rule in the Talmud that you can't do business with an idolater 3 days before their holiday and 3 days after their holiday. Think about what that might do to Jews who had business interests and partnerships in Christian Europe. Think about that for a second. If Sunday is a Christian holiday and you can't do business with Christians 3 days before their holiday and you can't do business with Christians 3 days after their holiday, ain't much time to do business, is there? This was a huge problem, and Talmudic commentators had to deal with this problem and explain why people still were engaged in business relationships with Christians on a consistent basis. Okay, so that's the first type of prohibition we have here. Number two, there, as I said, there are certain areas of halakha where they have lower rights and obligations. Let's say returning lost objects, you know, or even while the prevailing opinion in the Talmud is it's prohibited, it's gezeilah, it's theft to steal from a non-Jew, there is no formal obligation to return a lost object to a non-Jew according to the Talmud. That's what it says, take it or leave it. That's what the Talmud says. Why that might be, maybe because you're going above and beyond for people of the covenant, because when people lose things, there are interesting explanations, but that's what Talmud says. And then category three is generally, you know, things that we do to discourage intermarriage, like drinking, you know, eating, let's say, non-Jewish cooking, bishul akum, things like that. We want to discourage intermarriage. Okay. The Me'iri severely limited categories one and two, meaning for the Me'iri, and then this is complicated and controversial, and look at the PhDs and look at the sources, but on a very general level, for the Me'iri, categories one and two are no longer applicable to the Gentiles in our midst. And that is for two reasons. One is a notion that Christianity is not idolatry, at least for non-Jews. At least for non-Jews, it's not idolatry. And a specific openness toward Christianity. And number two is the notion that all of the laws wrote in the Talmud, that were written in the Talmud relating to Gentiles, only apply to barbarous Gentiles. The Gentiles of the days of the Talmud who were barbarians and thieves and horrible people. That's who the laws apply to. But in our day, says the Me'iri, they are no longer applicable. Take a look at the Me'iri here in source. I have to run a bit quickly, but I'll just give you this. For it is the common practice in all lands to trade with those among whom they dwell, in all commodities and all manner of commerce. Meaning, there's a prohibition against selling Gentiles incense because they might use the incense for idolatry. So that's the Meiri, no longer applicable. Even on their holiday, it seems certain that the reason is that these rules were enacted only for their times, when the worship of idols was widespread for sacrifice and thanksgiving, as you see in the reference to their festival days. We see in the Torah, they worship the heavenly hosts and the sun, the moon, trees, and stones. Gentiles today don't do that. And Meiri saying the reason that Jews have not been abiding by these laws is because they're no longer applicable. Now, that is a dangerous thing to say. I would not have the shoulders to say something like that. But the Meiri was a big rabbi and an incredible Torah scholar, and he felt he did have the shoulders to say things like this. Another reference here, now this is again, and there's a lot to say about this, and I'm not going to cover all of it. There are certain references to the Christians specifically in the Talmud. That's what it seems to be, at least. Okay? The Meiri, it's worth noting that there might be some apologetics here. Some have suggested the Christians were involved in Jewish texts. They censored some things, so that might be at work. But the Meiri tries to read any reference to Christians per se out of the Talmud, so that when the Talmud says Notzrim, Nazarenes, usually meaning Christians, right? And that Notzrim are Ovdei Avodah Zarah and Yom Eidam, their holiday is Sunday, the Meiri says Notzrim doesn't mean Christians, it means followers of Nebuchadnezzar, Notzrim, Babylonians. It's not Christians. You can do business with Christians. You should treat them like you would any other Jew, right? That is controversial. It is not the widely accepted interpretation of that Gemara. There's no doubt that tradition generally for most of history did not accept this ruling of the Meiri. I think you can appreciate where it's coming from, which is that I think his main argument, I would say, and in a nutshell, there's so much to say about this, and there's a ton to study, but I think what the Meiri is saying is that laws have a certain context and a certain, you know, are for a certain social milieu, and that, you know, that when the Talmud makes or promulgates certain laws, it's specific to their social reality, and we have to be cognizant of that in a certain sense. And also the general view that God and all people are created with Tzel Melukim, all people can have a connection with God, and that we should treat people accordingly. Now, again, that is controversial, and you can, you know, think in that way. The downside is then, like, once the Meiri is telling us certain laws in Talmud no longer apply, you know, why stop there? Maybe there are other laws that we think are not progressive enough and that should no longer apply. I'm not denying that. It is dangerous in a certain sense. But it's worth noting the Meiri, who is an incredible, prodigious Torah scholar, thought this way. And it doesn't just extend to Gentiles, this is what we'll end with, it extends to women as well. Now, as we, you know, noted, the traditional or medieval beliefs toward women, although I don't think they were discriminatory on purpose, they didn't mean to discriminate, but they were not progressive. Let's just say it that way. And the Talmud, if isn't a feminist work, I think if we're honest with ourselves. And the Meiri, I'm not even saying that if someone was, you know, of a certain, you know, liberal bent, that they would be thrilled with everything the Meiri said about women. I don't think they would. But he's certainly more open. Take a look at the Meiri on Erevin, 96a. You already know that women are exempt from positan bal mitzvot, right? Mitzvot that are positive time, mitzvot things that have to be done at a certain time, women are not obligated in those commandments. So lulav, women can do the mitzvah lulav, but they don't have to. Women can, sit in the sukkah, they don't have to, because they're time-bound mitzvot. So you have also learned that regarding tefillin, since Shabbat and Yom Tov are in time to don tefillin, they are time-bound positive mitzvot. However, if they want to do it, they have permission two. And there is no prohibition of thou shalt not add. There is no problem of adding to the Torah. But the Torah didn't come to be strict toward them, but rather to be lenient. That is controversial. most Orthodox authorities do not accept this opinion of the Meir. The Meir is saying women can do as many mitzvot as they want. They also can participate in our tradition, however they, you know, and you know, engage in spiritual growth. Now, if the what would the Meir say nowadays with sort of the certain political agendas of people and, you know, and all the different movements? I'm not sure. But at least here he's saying women can do a mitzvot, and they should. And if they want to wear tefillin, they can do that too. Number two, take a look here. There's a certain statement in the Gemara in Sota, which is disparaging toward certain types of behavior by women. And the Meiri, though, makes the following comment. All women whose piety is proper and sincere, God forbid that any doubt has been said about their purity. Many of them have been found to be more fearful of sin and meticulous than men. So the Meiri here is arguing that women can be engaged in mitzvot and pure and meticulous and fearful of sin, and sort of trying to at least push back to some degree against this hierarchy. So in conclusion, I think I've shown that there are different thinkers in Provence. Meiri was an innovator, someone who is definitely steeped in tradition and in Torah knowledge, but also willing to be innovative and to use his wisdom to properly structure a new viewpoint toward the times that he lived in. And I think it's definitely very instructive for our time today. And so I think it's worth thinking about as we bring our series to a close in Provence, that there are different types of thinkers. And there are going to be Raavids, and there's going to be Meiris, and there's going to be Moshe HaRashans, and they're all rooted in Torah, and they're different approaches to the world and how they see applying Torah to the world and how they view the best way of protecting our tradition. But they're all part of our Masorah, and it's worth appreciating all of them. So with that, we'll close. Sorry, I went a bit over time. Thank you very much. Please join us next week for Bechor Chinuri series.
Thank you.